welcome to Tales from the Arcanist. I'm your host, Patrick Morris. Together, we'll be enjoying flash fiction stories from around the world. In this installment, we'll be walking through a disease-ridden wasteland, fighting off zombies for a candy bar, going toe-to-toe with customer service, and more. Sit back, relax, and listen. This is Tales from the Arcanist. Heal Thyself by Joshua Alexander. It struck in January. By June, they estimated half the human population had died. It was September now. The car could have gone further, but Wade Davis couldn't bring himself to pull the poor bastard from behind the blood-spattered wheel. His name was Enrique. He was the first person Davis had seen for 2 weeks. He looked down from the empty bend of state route onto the deserted city below and decided to keep moving onward, outward, away. To the dam, maybe. That was Enrique's plan. Enrique thought they were both immune, but Davis knew he wasn't the moment he laid eyes on him. Gray rings around the iris. A dead giveaway. They never found out how or why it went dormant in some people. Hell, they never really knew what it was. Best guess was a weapon. In light of that, the purpose of its uneven gestation period was clear: to cause as much chaos as possible. When it did hide, it hid in the liver and bone marrow, disrupting the metabolism of copper and causing dark colorations in the eye called Kaiser-Fleischer rings. Davis didn't tell him because he knew it wouldn't do any good. He needed Enrique. He couldn't stand to be alone anymore. It was a Marburg virion of some type, they were fairly sure. Elusive and difficult to model. What they did know about the Marburgs and the other hemorrhagic fevers suggested that mutations of the Niemann-Pick C1 and C2 genes were good indicators for resistance. Davis won the jackpot. And was alone because of it. He kept trying to get his things out of the back, but just ended up retching over the guardrail. He couldn't look at Enrique. On the third try, he managed to get the backpack, faded garbage bag of clothes, and ID badge. Depending on who he met, showing them an NIH identification might do more harm than good. They had to blame somebody. Davis filled his crumpled water bottle in a roadside ditch when the sun was going down. He dropped in one of the purification tablets that he was debating hiding from Enrique and watched it bubble away, imparting a chlorine taste to the filthy water. He supposed not having to share them now was another sort of jackpot. He curled up in a culvert for the night, the taste of muddy pool water and loneliness commingling, and set out again before first light. Another day, another bottle of muddy pool water. Another night, another culvert, and the dreams. The ones he had when he was alone. In his dream, Davis's old colleagues, with blood in their eyes and mouths, calmly explained to him that the mutation that saved him doesn't necessarily get inherited. He listened, not like their research director, but like a third grader listening to a guest speaker. They drew Punnett squares in their own blood, and the dream ended when he ran home to save his family. He could never save Catherine, but Megan had a 50-50 shot at the jackpot. His doctoral advisor once said that heritability was the devil playing Russian roulette with a double-barreled shotgun. He slept in a fire lookout tower that third night and reached the dam the next day. There were people there, just like Enrique said. They had barricades, a watchtower, even working vehicles. Men patrolled the chain link and made no hurry to greet him, just watched him trudge up all the way to the gate. "Who are you?" the sharpshooter in the tower called down. Men kept their distance, merely handled their weapons, and didn't point them. They weren't nervous. That was good. "My name's Wade Davis. I'm not sick, I'm..." "Doc?" came a voice from behind the fence. "Dr. Davis?" He blinked at a face he didn't recognize. A young man in a mariner's cap and a scraggly beard laced his fingers through the chain link, eyeing him. It must have been the hunger-pinched face or the beard, but once Davis got a good look, it clicked. "Daniel?" he said. He didn't remember his last name. Before he knew it, the gates were open to him. They apologized for the suspicion, fed him, and he was seeing patients immediately. Daniel said that their camp doctor died a week prior. He had left to treat a caravan of new arrivals they didn't think were infected. He and a few nurses were all they had here. "So, you graduated after all?" Davis asked, bandaging up a workman. "Not exactly," he chuckled. Part of that was Davis's fault, he knew. He wasn't a forgiving professor. Thankfully, that was 3 years ago, before getting involved with the filovirus research for the National Institutes of Health. So far, nobody knew where he'd come from, only what he could do. Daniel had been visiting family between leathernecking jobs when the fever hit. He heard good people were doing good things here, and he and his family came. Like me, Davis thought. Only less of a coward. The engineers kept the dam operational for the research facilities and the army, and their families kept the place self-sufficient. They had fresh gardens, chicken coops, laughing children running underfoot. It was good. It felt like it could be home. But it couldn't, could it? Over the next few days, Daniel helped train new nurses. But the dreams returned. It wasn't long before Davis started seeing rings in the younger man's eyes. The day the first workman started coughing, he knew they'd be dead that afternoon. There were whispers and glances. He packed that night, stole some supplies, cut the fence along an unpatrolled section. Some of the girls talked about a similar setup outside Spokane with thousands of people, almost a proper city. He'd make for there. He knew he ought to do what was right for them, for everyone. To kill himself, to stop spreading it. He was a carrier, he knew, but he didn't want to be alone anymore.
Joshua Alexander is an activist and amateur author of science fiction and fantasy from West PA. His work has appeared in Swords and Sorcery magazine.
Brick Red Love by Don Vogel. Today was supposed to be the happiest day in Tanit's life, her wedding day. But it was still 3 hours to the wedding, and Tanit had already had her fill of the chaos. She slipped out of the dressing room while everyone else oohed and aahed and giggled and squealed over how beautiful Vicky's hair was, studded with several dozen rhinestones. They'd glimmer even through her veil. Most brides selected their home church for their wedding, but Tanith hadn't been home in years. Vicky didn't have a home church either, so they'd settled on this little, non-denominational chapel in the middle of the woods. Tanith headed for a small clearing she and Vicky had found behind the church when they first visited. It was tranquil outside, still an hour or more before the first guests would be arriving. She could get a few minutes of peace, then head back in for the final touches on her dress, makeup, and hair. The last thing she expected to see in the clearing was a door. Her breath caught in her throat. This was not just any door. It was the door to her parents' house, halfway across the country. There was no mistaking the bold brick-red paint, nor the carved door jamb that surrounded it. She ran her fingers over the wood, finding the places where she and her siblings had defaced the door jamb in the subtlest of ways, adding an extra line here, a hole there, leaving their mark on the family home. She was still touching the door jamb when the door flew open, her father standing within. "What are you doing, Tanith? Come in from the cold." It wasn't cold where she was standing, but her father was bundled up in a sweater and wool slacks. It would be cold where he was. But how could he be here, or she be there? Tanith glanced back toward the chapel, then looked at her father. "How?" He shrugged. "Haven't a clue. Don't look a gift horse in the mouth. Come in and say hello to everyone." She peered past her father. Pots and pans clanged in the kitchen. Her mother was an apparition in the cloud of steam hovering at the kitchen door. Some of her nieces and nephews played a card game on the living room floor. Her brother Davis had fallen asleep stretched out on the couch, while her sister-in-law, Nora, knitted nearby. The others were probably in the backyard, in spite of the cold. The aroma of chili wafted over her, and her mouth watered. One of her nieces, April, Tanith thought, though she'd only seen the girl in photos, waved her cards in Tanith's direction. Home, with the smells and the memories. Her heart ached. She wanted to share it with the woman who'd won her heart. "Let me go get Vicky." "No time," her father grabbed her by the wrist, gripping it tight. Tanith jerked away. "No, she should come too. I mean, we're getting married today. She's part of the family." Her father crossed his arms over his chest, and Tanith shuddered. This was too unreal, and yet too real. Her father managed to express his disapproval across time and space, his glare making her feel 10 years old again when he had lectured her that kissing other girls wasn't what nice young ladies did. "You don't want to see her. You just want to pull me away," Tanith said, shaking her head. Figures. We just want you to come home, Tanith. Tanith took a deep breath. She'd endure the chaos of wedding preparation to not be here right now. Too bad. I don't want to come home. She took a step backward. Tell the family I said hello, if you would. I miss them. And me? Her father asked. Tanith shrugged. A little bit. But not enough to deny my heart. We hope you'll come around someday. She didn't give him an opportunity to respond, turning and running back into the dressing room. Vicky looked up when Tanith entered. Where have you been, love? Tanith leaned down and kissed Vicky's shoulder where it met her neck, avoiding the makeup and hairspray. I thought I needed some fresh air. Didn't help, though. Maybe some water instead. Vicky caught Tanith's hand and kissed it, leaving a brick-red lipstick print there, the same color as the door to Tanith's childhood home. Somebody got a pair of earbuds Tanith can use? She smiled at Tanith. Marge can work on her magic while you relax. Tanith smiled back and clutched the hand with the lipstick print to her heart. It might look ridiculous in the wedding photos, but she wasn't going to let anyone clean it off her hand. It was all the love she needed.
Dawn Vogel is a member of Broad Universe, Science Fiction Writers of America, and Codec Writers. Her steampunk series, Brass and Glass, is being published by Razor Girl Press. She lives in Seattle with her husband, author Jeremy Zimmerman, where they publish Mad Scientist Journal and are ruled over by their herd of cats. Visit her at historythatneverwas.com or on Twitter at historynevermind.
Vending Machine by Jeff Gard. The moment Pudge drops those 3/4, we are dead. 1/4 might have escaped the notice of the score of zombies who wander aimlessly through the abandoned hotel, but the sound of 3/4, one at a time, scraping through the slot, bouncing into the recesses of the vending machine like a plinko board, are like gunshots on a quiet suburban street. Although I snatch at Pudge's grimy fingers, he throws a shoulder into my gut and forces me back while he punches in the keys, A9. A metal coil whirls, forcing a chocolate bar to commit suicide and plunge several shelves to the bottom of the machine with several cringeworthy kerthunks. Even the door screeches as his hand darts in to retrieve the treat. Pudge's fingers tremble as he fumbles with the candy bar's sleeve. He has the look of a child who has discovered cotton candy for the first time. I would have killed him on the spot, except that he breaks the chocolate bar in half, and my mouth waters when I see the gooey tendril of caramel linking the two pieces. Angela? He asks when he notices my homemade silencer pressing in against his temple. I lower the gun and take the piece of chocolate. My eyes roll back involuntarily as the sweetness melts in my mouth and coats my dry throat. Neither of us has eaten for several days. In the machine there is a rainbow array of stale chips, resilient pretzels, old chocolate, and concretized packs of chewing gum. The feast practically glows under the flickering lights. If we smashed the glass, then we would have a smorgasbord of junk food. Unfortunately, we aren't the only ones looking for a buffet. Moaning and gurgling crescendos from shredded and decayed vocal cords just down the hall. I smell their putrefied flesh and moldy tatters of bloodstained clothing. A glance around a corner reveals both ends of the corridor are filled with the shuffling remnants of tourists in swimsuits, Hawaiian shirts, and fanny packs. We are pinned in by a vending machine and an ice maker, which had miraculously resurrected 5 minutes ago when the power surged to life unexpectedly. Pudge finishes his half, licks his fingers, and stiffens when he hears the unmistakable noise of the undead. His eyes grow large and contrite as he looks up at me. He mouths an apology, but it's too late. I almost shoot him again, but then I hesitate. Mom made me swear that I would protect him when she sacrificed herself 4 months ago. It isn't his fault he has the attention span of a hummingbird. Just 2 bullets would spare us a worse fate. I often wish Mom had used her gun on us instead of handing it off to me and pushing us toward our bikes. Months of bone-chilling weather, weeks of gnawing hunger pains, and uncomfortably short hours of sleep while one of us scans the horizon have leached optimism from my thoughts. Survival looks more like a game of Tetris, with every narrow escape creating a gap between the shapes that fills a screen at a hyperventilating pace. I look up and away from Pudge so he can't see me cry. Above us, I notice the air duct, just large enough for one of us. Pudge might be able to escape, or we could hide there until the danger is past. Up there. I cup my hands together and bend over. Pudge steps between my fingers, and I hoist him up to the vent. The cover falls away and strikes the metallic side of the ice maker with another bang. The moans intensify. They are so close I gag on the stench of their mortified flesh and bones and force myself to breathe through my mouth. Their fingers scrape along the walls just outside the door, their white eyes unable to see the opening, but their noses telling them that there is fresh meat nearby. Pudge slides feet first into the shaft. He motions for me to follow, but I shake him off. I hand him the gun instead. He looks at it in confusion for half a beat before his eyes widen in recognition. "Do it quick," I say, just above a whisper. "Hurry." Pudge bites his bottom lip. His hands are trembling so bad I am sure he will shoot me in the throat and leave me gasping for breath instead of nailing me between the eyes. Then he does what I did 4 months ago. One moment the gun is pointed at me. The next minute he takes his finger off the trigger. "Don't be selfish." My words sound eerily familiar, echoing my dead mother's last request. "You have to do this." But the urgency quickly fades from my voice as despair anesthetizes my fear. Like me, he can't murder someone he loves. I should be grateful, but I'm so pissed off I barely feel the first claws as they tug at my shirt and pants. A half dozen rotting teeth pinch against my exposed skin on my forearms and neck. A burning sensation flashes across my abdomen as shriveled fingers dig into me. I throw elbows at shattered faces and aim kicks at exposed knees, but my attackers are beyond pain. They barely notice my thrashing limbs. "Run, you son of a bitch," I implore Pudge. But he won't run. He will wait there until the change is complete, until the room clears of zombies. He will return to the vending machine, repeat the same mistake, and die. With a final lunge, I kick the glass of the vending machine, and it shatters inward. At least Pudge will make less noise next time. In response, an angry hornet stings my forehead, and blessed darkness floods in. I barely register the smoke spilling from the end of Pudge's gun.
Jeff is an assistant professor of English at Briarcliff University in Sioux City. In his spare time, he plays board games with his wife and ponders the deeper mysteries of life. Apologies for Any Inconvenience by Jennifer Milner. "Apologies, but I cannot renew your identification because it would appear that you are dead," said the voice emanating from the speaker above the computer hub at the National Identification Department. "What do you mean, I'm dead?" "According to our records, you are deceased," it said in a male voice that was programmed to be friendly but just didn't quite pass the uncanny valley. "This must be a mistake," I laughed. "I'm standing here." "We plan perfectly, ma'am. We do not make mistakes," said the voice. "But I'm obviously not dead. Look, this is me," I said as I held the card up to the camera above the screen and mimicked the awkward smile in the hideous picture that adorned my ID card. "I cannot renew the identification of a deceased person," it said. "Please proceed upstairs to the Office of Records to further pursue this matter. Apologies for any inconvenience." "Apologies," said the female android sitting, well, perched would be more appropriate as she was only a torso set on a bar bolted to the floor, behind the counter in the Office of Records, "but our records indicate that you're dead." "Yes," I said, "that's why I'm here, to fix this mistake, because I'm obviously not dead." "We plan perfectly, ma'am. We do not make mistakes," it said in a voice that was supposed to be soothing but was just the tiniest bit robotic. I sighed. "Okay, well, I need copies of my birth certificate and this death certificate so I can sort this out." "Certainly. Please present your identification." I put my ID card in her hand, and she scanned it with her palm. She immediately handed it back. "This identification is expired. Please proceed to the identification department and complete the renewal process. Then you make return to complete your task." I pressed my lips together in frustration. "I can't renew my ID because the computer says I'm dead, and they won't renew the ID of a dead person. Can't I just talk to a living human being about this?" I said with annoyance. She was silent for a moment as I watched her empty robot eyes twitch just the slightest bit while she processed the information. Please proceed upstairs to the office of the adjudicator to further pursue this matter. Apologies for any inconvenience.
Apologies, said the real woman sincerely, standing behind the counter, but I'm afraid the deadline to appeal your death is past. The thing is, I didn't know I was dead, because it never occurred to me I might be dead. Because I'm alive. Yes, but I'm afraid the law is airtight on this, she said with deep sympathy. How can there not be a way to fix this? I'm standing here in front of you. You can see me with your own eyes. I'm obviously not dead. This is a huge mistake! I screamed the last part, finally losing all ability to be diplomatic. The crowded room went silent as I felt the eyes of all the other people bore into me while they went about their perfectly planned and efficient business. She was silent for a single beat.
We plan everything perfectly, ma'am. We don't make mistakes, she said, her tone still friendly, but forced, her smile twitching ever so slightly at the corners of her lips.
Obviously, you do, I said.
She looked back at her computer and typed away, her brow furrowed, her warm demeanor cooled. After a few moments of monotonous tapping of keys, her face softened again, and her smile returned.
Please proceed upstairs to the Office of Administration to rectify this matter. Apologies for any inconvenience.
Apologies, said the well-coiffed man in the sharp suit sitting behind his desk. I see there was an aberration in a clerical algorithm in the Office of Information. It's such a relief to finally talk to someone who can fix this mistake.
I'm certain this has been a very frustrating experience for you, ma'am. We always strive to deal with matters such as this as quickly as possible.
He printed something up and handed me the paper. I looked down at it and saw my first and last name, my identification number, and a barcode.
Please proceed downstairs to operations and protocols to rectify this matter. Apologies for any inconvenience.
The waiting room in operations and protocols was bright, cozily decorated, and comfortable. I'd been told by the android that escorted me here that the wait wouldn't be long. A soothing female voice called my name through the speaker, and I went through the door to what I'd expected to be another office. Instead, I found myself in a white, shiny, windowless room. Where am I? I was sent up here to fix the mistake made about me being dead.
We do not make mistakes, ma'am, said the voice. Your situation is currently being remedied.
A pleasant smell filled the room, and my mind started to grow fuzzy. I could feel my heartbeat slowing as my breathing grew more labored. The last thing I heard before I closed my eyes was the soothing female voice.
Apologies for any inconvenience your death may cause you.
Jennifer Milne has been writing short stories and novels for 10 years. She's been published by Rogue Phoenix Press and multiple literary magazines. She lives in San Diego with her family. That concludes this volume of Tales from the Arcanist. Read these stories and hundreds more for free at thearcanist.io. The Arcanist is edited by Josh Rolla, Andy Fulmer, and me, Patrick Morris. Find us on Patreon for more content, and follow us on Instagram at TheArcanistMag, on Twitter as The_Arcanists, and on Facebook at TheArcanists. The music from this episode is by Dimitri Diamores. If you liked this episode, please rate us on Apple Podcasts.